Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and today we have a treat for you. It's a triple header interview with Michael Gray Eyes, Maya Tailfeathers, and Jeff Barnaby, the two leads and the writer-director of the indigenous zombie film Blood Quantum, which you can currently see on Shudder and which will be coming out on video on demand, digital HD, DVD, and Blu-ray on September 1st. So definitely keep your eyes out for that one. Go get it. Go watch it. This is a very deep movie, a zombie film from a different perspective, and it dances on and around some topics in a way that most horror fans aren't accustomed to seeing, but it's well worth a watch. The cinematography is beautiful. The music, for me, was very affecting. And without further ado, we're going to jump into our interviews. Hi, welcome back to more Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and my guest now is actor Michael Gray Eyes, who is in the new zombie horror post-apocalyptic thriller Blood Quantum, which is coming out on Blu-ray, DVD, and digital on September 1st. Michael plays the tribal sheriff Trailer in a very tense and poignant story. Welcome, Michael.
Oh, thank you very much, Summer. I appreciate the invitation.
Now, this was, for me, a really, really fun movie. It was the cinematography is excellent. The acting is both humorous and chilling. And you play the tribal sheriff who's caught between five different rocks and three hard places.
I love that description. It's really great. Trailer is a beautiful character, beautifully complex and dimensional person. Jeff's writing is, Jeff, our writer, director, and editor, you know, our mastermind. He writes really beautiful and complex people. So, you know, when I first read the script, I was really blown away by the sort of complex histories built into all his relationships. You know, he's got two sons. Both, you know, the sons are, you know, they're like a coin. Like there's like a lighter half, a darker half, good, bad. But honestly, they're both products of Trailer. So Trailer himself is full of light and shadow. And, you know, that really drew me to wanting to play him.
How did you come across the story or the script? Because this, like I said, this story is very, very moving. It touches on the tensions between the First Nations people and the townies, so to speak. It dives into the complex relationships when you have people living daily in situations that are emotionally traumatic, physically traumatic. And there's just so many layers in this story.
Yeah. I'm delighted, you know, that I got a chance to read for Trailer. I first heard about the project through Brandon Oakes, who's one of the players, one of the actors. And, you know, we were working on a theater project, and Brandon said, yeah, I'm going to be working on Jeff's new film. And I was like, how do I get on one of those? You know, because I'm a huge fan of his work. And then later that fall, my agents, my reps, we got the audition notice, and they said, you know, we'd like Michael to read for Trailer. And I was so excited. I was like, you know, I didn't even have to honestly read the whole script to be like, where do I sign up? You know, like, please take me. You know, I had my hand like raised up over my head. But I did the audition, and then they liked it, and then they asked me to do a callback, and then you know, I booked the job. At that point, we thought we might be filming in the late fall, but, you know, we were filming in Canada, and so, you know, weather's always a little tricky. in the fall and spring. So we actually pushed it to the next year. So we filmed it in Montreal in the spring of next year. And it was brutal. It was cold and it was wet. But I think that kind of pathetic fallacy really worked for our project.
Like I said, the cinematography in this is very impressive. And I think the winter or near winter setting added to some of the atmosphere of desperate hopelessness that everybody is feeling once you can't really spoil it because zombie outbreak, plague outbreak.
Yeah.
And I did not expect some of the turns that were coming. The trailer's father was Gizigu. His no-nonsense attitude, especially when looking at the fish who have come back to life. the whole attitude was, well, this is something. All right, let's deal with it. Kind of.
I know. Yeah. There's a matter-of-factness to it that I think it speaks to the genre. It speaks to how indigenous stories fit into horror and genre and sci-fi. Jeff said something super interesting. He goes, honestly, like if you look at a lot of, communities, like, life on the res, he said, like how much in the communities that are really struggling, like how much would the end of the world change their actual experience? Like, supply chains are down. There's scarcity, there's food scarcity, there's violence from outsiders, there's all kinds of conflict embedded in some communities, certainly not all. But he said, how much would the end of the world change that? He said, some of us have already been living in the apocalypse. So I think that was a really key idea certainly myself and, lots of people in the community are drawn to stories like this. Stories, post-apocalyptic stories, sci-fi, imaginative spaces where we see ourselves quite easily as part of that landscape.
Yeah, it's a real eye-opener to encounter a story centered on a group of people for whom the breakdown of societal norms is just another day in their lives. It's like, yeah, okay, so we have to shoot more of walking, shuffling undead things. Nothing else has changed.
Exactly. I think there's a kind of a grim, like 1,000-yard stare, a soldier that's been in the shit for a long time. Mm-hmm. There's like just a matter of factness about like, well, we survive. That's what we do. And that's what we've been doing since Columbus sailed, the ocean's blue.
So what was your approach to having Trailer deal with this new problem on top of the other issues he's trying to juggle in his life? Because he becomes a de facto leader in the compound once people realize that the residents of the reserve, the indigenous, the tribal people, are kind of immune to this plague, and they realize they have to protect themselves from the rest of the scared, frightened, desperate, envious world.
Yeah. When you look at the film, when you look at the structure of it, there are really two films. There's the film about the outbreak, and then there's film about the aftermath. And they happen to involve the same characters, so we can actually draw inferences between the two worlds. But my character, Trailer, he's actually a very shitty dad, and he's a pretty lousy sheriff. It takes the end of the world for this guy who is complicated and flawed to finally understand what it means to be a decent father. To be a father who's not selfish, who's not self-absorbed, who's not caught up in his own drama, but actually decides to take on, as you described, a leadership role in helping his community survive. the very fact that some of the same questions that play out in Jeff's film are questions that we communities face, you know, nearly 600 years ago. What do we do with these outsiders? We are human. We recognize their humanity. I don't know. Maybe we should help them. They're kind of pathetic. They're kind of pitiful. And within those communities, there's that very, very convincing argument. Yeah, but what happens if we help them survive and then they turn on us? What happens if we help them settle, help them learn how to live on this land, and then they don't leave? So the same colonial questions, the same questions about what do we do with our humanity as hosts, and we look at invaders and you know, these sort of rapacious hordes, like, you know, zombies. Hello. It's a comment both on colonialism and consumerism, you know, as we found out from the early zombie films, but also in Jeff's hands, this is really a brutal expose of colonial attitudes towards us, our bodies, and our land.
There's also a little touch of, you know, what happens when everyone adopts a colonial attitude, because that's all they've been exposed to their entire lives. There's sort of an absorption of ideas there that there's no way to avoid.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, without giving much away, I think the end of the movie, the final images that we see, actually speak to that question. It's like, okay, so if really what we're talking about is resource protection, survival mechanisms, what in the end matters? What in the end is important to us? Mm-hmm. And really what the final images of the film ask us to consider is that actually the only thing that's important is our loyalty towards each other. It's the idea of sacrifice, and it's the idea of life and preserving it at all costs.
Yeah, I think that whole final sequence sort of asks you to question, what does survival really mean?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I was actually quite, I saw the film when it premiered at TIFF. The Midnight Madness series, it opened Midnight Madness. And I really, I knew that it was going to be a fun ride. I knew that it was going to be, you know, a great horror film. But what I didn't expect is the emotional impact of what these characters meant to me. And I remember, you know, as the credits rolled, I had a lump in my throat the size of an apple. I couldn't talk. You know, I was wiping my eyes. I was like, oh my God, I got to go up on stage now and talk about the film. I said, I'm shook up. So yeah, I think that's the beauty of the film, is that it provides this template that I think we're all really familiar with. But at its heart, it's a story about people. It's an emotionally hard hitting story. And really it's a profound experience to be left with those questions.
Yeah, I was very moved by the tribal music selected. I mean, the song that's playing over the end credits, like, literally got me choking up a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. Jeff's a really smart filmmaker, and, you know, he composed some of the music for the film. He's one of those guys that's literally like, he sees the entire thing in his head, and he works doggedly, you know, tirelessly to make it happen.
Cool. Well, Michael, thank you so much for your time today. Are there any spaces on social media where people can keep up with what you're working on next?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram and Twitter. So look for the blue tick, and that's me. Thank you so much, Summer.
Thank you. And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this. Hi, welcome back to more Slices Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and with me now is Elmaya Tailfeathers, who plays Joss in the zombie flick Blood Quantum, which is very entertaining, and I suggest everyone go see it right now. The movie will be out on Blu-ray and digital on September 1st. Welcome, Maya.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, your character is Joss, who is Joseph's mother and trailer's ex. The range of, I guess, empathy that you have for everyone, despite the chaos that's going on, is just poignant and compelling. Where did you see your character going when you got this story, the script?
Well, thank you. I think Jeff did a phenomenal job of writing this character. And to me, she represented so many Indigenous women I know within our communities who are dealing with so much on every level, and still managed to, you know, move forward with love for our communities and for our people and our families. And so I just did my best to channel that, to recognize that there's so many women like Joss whose work goes on quietly behind the scenes. And I really appreciate Jeff writing a character like her. It was an honor to play Joss.
What appealed to you more, the character of Joss or just the inventiveness of the story?
All of it appealed to me. Jeff Barnaby, the director, is a really important voice within the Indigenous film community and the Canadian film world. And so I, you know, watched his work for years and really admired what he created, and jumped at the opportunity to work with him. And it was a really incredible experience to watch him work, and to see his sort of deep thought behind every decision that he made in the script. So yeah, I thought it was a wildly inventive, bizarre story that in a lot of ways just reflects what Indigenous people have already been through and continue to experience on a daily basis, just framed through this world of genre. And yeah, it was an honor to play Joss and to work with the phenomenal cast of the film. Everybody was such a pleasure to work with.
What for you was the most important part about getting where Joss's heart is, where her beliefs are amidst this collapse of the world around them?
It was all about making the choice to move forward with love, to recognize that it's love that got our communities and our people through everything we've been through already. And so my sort of guiding choice in everything I did with that character was about love, and moving forward with nothing but hope despite everything that's happened, because I, you know, every day reflected on what our ancestors have experienced and what our communities continue to experience, which can very much feel like a horror film or science fiction, but it's reality, and it can be challenging to sort of contend with that. And sometimes, you know, I find myself going numb in response to all of that. Mm-hmm. But the choices I made in playing Joss were about love and hope despite all odds.
Now, I don't want to spoil too much of the movie because there are, like I said, I highly recommend people see this because the cinematography and the acting are just so compelling. But a lot of it seems to take place or does take place in a more wintry setting. What challenges did you face on set at all because of the weather, the setting, you know, building a fortress against zombies, any of it?
Well, the production crew was incredible. the special effects team, set designers, everybody was just really wonderful to work with and just so incredibly talented. So there were a few days where it was like, I don't know, nature was just throwing us for a loop. Like there was this freak snowstorm that hit in, I believe it was October, very early October, and made things very challenging. But the crew proceeded with just so much passion. There was so much about this film that was challenging in a good way. Like we had a lot of night shoots. I remember at one point we were on set for just like what felt like forever, because just the level of challenge for the special effects team at one point was just like, I just couldn't believe they were achieving what they were achieving and the dedication that they displayed and like getting through this marathon of a day was pretty incredible. So like anytime that I felt tired, I just looked at everybody else and recognized that we're kind of in it together.
Well, Joss being a nurse and at the compound, the primary medical professional, you actually got to get your hands into a lot more of the special effects blood. What were your challenges in, okay, I'm digging into guts here, I'm just cleaning blood off of people, I'm sewing up, wounds?
It was like nothing I'd ever done before. But again, it was like the depictions of violence, the sort of gruesome aspects of the story, although they feel somewhat fantastical in a sense or otherworldly, I think to a lot of us Indigenous people are a metaphor for the very real forms of violence that we witness and feel on a daily basis. And so, working in that context, it was always just kind of like, it was always there, was always present, just this constant reminder that what we were doing was rooted in a sense of realism. And yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely a sense in the film, like an undercurrent of the zombie hordes, the infected masses trying to come into what has been defined as a safe space for the Indigenous community for that area, because they are safe from the problems outside the borders, and that it feels like another attack. And just the visceral, the underlying oppressiveness of that thought on top of, hey, zombies, was just so, so well played.
Yeah, it's an incredible script and a very unique film, and I think Jeff did an excellent job of all of that.
Were there any changes to what was written after you guys got out and started shooting parts of the story? Like, were there any changes in your character's dialogue or what happens?
Very, very minor things, but I think they really had to stick to the script just given all of the requirements for the special effects. Like there was just so much thought and effort that went into every detail with the special effects. So it was really interesting to work in this capacity where special effects were such a big part of every decision that was made in every scene. I'd never worked in that sort of way before, and it was a really fun sort of technical aspect of the shoot.
I'm trying not to spoil anything for the movie, but there comes a moment where Joss apparently has to take over leadership of the survivors from Trailer. Was there any thought to how you would approach that shift in her character?
Well, I didn't really see it as a shift. I perceived her as being a quiet leader throughout. And I think that has to do with reflecting on all of the Indigenous women in our communities who are doing the real work quietly behind the scenes. And so to me, there wasn't really a shift in leadership in that sense. I think she was quietly leading throughout, and in many ways was sort of a matriarch in the making. So yeah, I guess to answer your question, there wasn't really all that much of a shift in that sense. It was just, I guess, a shift in perspective for the audience.
And for you, what was the most fun part of filming?
Oh man, the cast was incredible. It was such a phenomenal cast to work with. Everybody was so funny. Like, despite the heavy subject matter and all of that, there was just like so much laughter on set. There's quite a few moments when I watch the film and just like remember that I was busting a gut like right before they called action, and then you have to like jump into this serious zombie killing mode. But yeah, my favorite aspect of all of it was just working with the rest of the cast. Everybody was such a joy to work with.
Now, I'm going to be a little bit selfish and say that I want to see a sequel or an aftermath story about what happens to people who continue to survive after things go sideways. is that something you guys might have talked to Jeff about?
You know, I think he briefly mentioned it, but he's always got seemingly a lot of different things on the go, and so I know that he has some exciting projects coming up, and I would definitely be open to a sequel. I think it would be, especially in light of what's happening with COVID, I think mm-hmm. it would be really great to imagine a world post-apocalypse and post-pandemic.
Now, are you on social media at all where people can keep track of you and your upcoming projects?
Yeah, people can follow me on Instagram. I have a public Instagram profile people can follow.
Awesome. Well, we will include those links in the show notes. Maya, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, it was really nice to chat with you, Summer. Take care.
The lonely alien pet bravely waits for the family that may never return. An astronaut with seconds to live discovers just how good victory can taste. A mecha pilot and an aristocrat strike up an unlikely friendship. Take a ride with Escape Pod, the Hugo-nominated weekly science fiction podcast, at escapepod.org. Every week will launch you into an alternate reality, so buckle up, it's story time.
Hi, welcome to more Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and with me now is Jeff Barnaby, the writer and director of Blood Quantum, which is a zombie film you definitely do not want to miss. It'll be out on Blu-ray and digital on September 1st. Hi, Jeff. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Now, this movie was a delight, a surprise. It was both emotional and for the gore lovers a treat.
Thank you.
Where did you come up with the idea for this story, the themes for this story? Because there are a whole lot of levels to this story.
Initially it was just the idea of circumventing a played out genre. Zombie films have been oversaturated, the market's been oversaturated. My management team are the guys behind The Walking Dead, and they were like, you don't want to do a zombie film. And I was like, well, I kind of do. So it really stemmed from trying to make an original take on that genre. And then when I sat down with the initial conceit of, you know, Native people are going to be immune, it just became obvious what the film was going to be about. And it was pretty, I wouldn't say simple. It was more the idea of how do you jam all these themes into 90 minutes or 96 minutes, whatever it was. That was the problem. And the initial script was like 140 pages or something like that, because there was just so much material to wade through. And it took 15 years to make, and you have a lot of time to think about stuff. So it was really a matter of, you know, picking the best ideas and, you know, finding a vehicle for them, and then turning the film into something that could be what you just mentioned, fun for genre fans to watch. So you don't get bogged down in the politics, or I feel like if you're going to see a film, you don't want to get lectured. And it was really about coding the ideas to the point where you could still enjoy it as a zombie film, but if you unpacked it, you'd find more stuff there the more often you watch it, or the more you pay attention to it.
Yeah, there's a lot of underlying themes that come across just in the way that the characters behave, both before the outbreak and after the outbreak. And it just makes the world they're in feel lived in, feel authentic. And that makes what we're seeing them go through during the outbreak, during the aftermath, so much more visceral, so much more emotionally connecting, at least for me anyway.
I think for me, one of the things that we were going to try to do was make the threat of the zombies almost be a secondary. Like, we're not worried about the zombies, we're worried about the live people. Because whereas you can handle a stupid zombie, it's more of the threat really is more the idea of the non-native or the white characters. And you see it when you jump into the second act. I'm surprised nobody really ever picked up on it. This idea that this guy that goes in there with his daughter is kind of a suicide bomber, in the sense that he knows when he dies, he's going to turn into a zombie. So he goes in there and he kills himself. And that is where we start really getting into more transgressive ideas, mm-hmm. where you're flipping the ideas and everything becomes ironic. The main character, or one of the main characters, Lysol, he's the one that's, you know, almost taking on the mantle of being the racist, or the guy that's saying, well, we need to build a wall, and, you know, we need to keep these immigrants out of here. I mean, that was the idea of taking this current climate of xenophobia and racism and almost showing it to a audience that wouldn't look at it from that perspective, and seeing what we got. And who the hell knew, right? Because it's the first time anybody's done anything like this, really, what we were doing. And it's almost like getting out of a relationship. You know, you don't really know what was going on until you get the perspective of time and distance. And it's like, oh, wow, you start seeing all these things. And then it gets exacerbated by the idea that we're in the middle of I don't even know what to describe it as. I mean, obviously the pandemic, what the pandemic did was cast a light on our culture, and it kind of showed all the ugly details that people have been ignoring for so long.
Yeah, the scene with the one guy with his daughter trying to sneak her in. I'm sitting there watching this, and then when he kills himself, I'm like, wait, this is... How in the world could this have been written to be a commentary on people going, I don't want to wear a mask? This is I'm sitting here watching this going, no, he's prescient. He can see the future. What in the world happened here? And just seeing all of the themes about fear and xenophobia and the all encompassing, we have to get rid of all of them, there are no exceptions, things that we're seeing reflected in today's, shall we say, adverse reaction to bad things happening for a long period of time. I'm like, ow, okay.
Yeah, it's really hard to, well, it's hard to wrap your head around.
Yeah.
Not only, I mean, really the reality of what we're experiencing right now is hard to wrap your head around, where the very act of living or dying becomes a political statement. And I'm even having a hard time trying to articulate it. It seems that people are commodifying a disease or completely ignoring it altogether, where you're seeing what I've known for a long time, and I think what Native people have known for a long time, that capitalism, the main commodity of capitalism isn't money, it's people. That's mm-hmm. what it eats, that's what it chews. And I think, you know, when you get a pandemic and everybody gets, you know, in a sense, equalized, whether they liked it or not, they're beginning to realize, like the Navajo Reservation would be a good example. It's like we've been living like this for quite some time without electricity, without water, without indemnities. I mean, like what you guys are complaining about as a privileged white society is what we've been going through the whole time you've been here. I mean, really, that's one of the main themes of the film. And I think that's kind of why you get people that either love it or hate it, because it's holding up a mirror to what everybody's experiencing right now.
Yeah, I can't understand why people would hate this movie based on the production values, the script, the characters. But I can understand where people from a certain walk of life would feel uncomfortable with having these things put so close to their existence, because it's criticizing them in a way that they've never been criticized before, and they have to acknowledge that it exists, or that makes them monsters themselves.
I mean, kind of, yeah. I mean, it's hard to quantify because of everything we're going through right now. I think it's existential, and when you get into that space, it's not something you just directly articulate. And I think our society at large, which is predominantly white, they've been trained. This is kind of the weird thing about being a Native person, right? You're using the very medium that's been used against you for 100 years to try to get some of the same ideas across. And I think when you invade that space, which has typically been like, you know, 100 years of cinema has been, you know, white men are awesome. That's really been the theme of everything. So when you start kind of subverting that, and when you start taking away those characters, and you're left with, you know, what have we done, a kind of reaction, I think it's hard. I mean, Jesus, you're looking at it play out right now, where nobody wants to come to terms with slavery, with genocide, with, you know, the things that really built North America, and mm-hmm. people have a tendency to localize it to the U.S. And it's not the U.S. Canada is not the polite society that you think it is. I mean, we had residential schools here. They had sterilization programs for Native women. I mean, there's all kinds of screwed up stuff going on here too. And it's not everybody going, hey, and, you know, drinking Molson Canadian and, you know, fighting on moose. I mean, it's a dark, brutal history that makes the conquerors really look like monsters. The idea that zombies are a metaphor for a culture that consumes everything in its path, and Jesus, that's like hitting somebody in the head with a shovel. And the weird thing about it is you kind of get distracted by the idea that it's a zombie film, in a sense that you're looking at the gore and you're looking at the action and the hyperbole and some of the brutality of the scenes. It's a mean-spirited movie too, so you're digesting all of that. But at the same time, you're kind of being criticized as a non-Native viewer, and in some cases a Native one too, because a lot of this comes from a community where blood quantum is enforced. This idea that we don't want you here because you've been with this white person. I mean, that's not a strange concept on reserves. That's actually quite common. And then you start talking about assimilation, appropriation. I mean, it's not, I don't think it's the film. I think it's the culture that we're in that's never dealt with the issues in the film.
Yeah, and the fact that they're having to consider dealing with it eventually, or else the rest of society is going to break down in a long-term, potentially permanent way. So a lot of people not reacting well to that concept.
the thing about that too, that's inevitable, right? I mean, when people tell you that our culture right now is unsustainable, when scientists tell you that the, you know, there's a finite resource, you can't build your culture onto a finite resource, which is oil. What do people hear? I don't understand. Like, we need to move away from this, and we're dealing with a culture that values the dollar right now, right here and now, more than they do the future. And it's again, you're in an existential conundrum where you don't know how or why people act like this. What is the end result? Mm-hmm. Like, I've never been rich, but I know rich people, and those rich people, I think, for the most part, are good. But what happens if you try to take that away from them? That's when you really see what you're dealing with. And it's kind of, you know, what we're seeing now. And yeah, I mean, like, right now, the culture we have, capitalism, is unsustainable. And there's two ways you can go about it, right? You can change from within, or you're going to get what you've seen over the course of, you know, civilization as we know it, and that's violent upheaval to force change.
We've talked too much about politics. I want to talk for half an hour about this movie. What, for you, was the most satisfying thing about finally getting this film made?
I think when you wrestle with something for as long as I wrestled with that film, it was more the idea of just saying you've done it and you survived it, and, you know, you have all these obstacles in front of you. And I've never really looked at them as obstacles. I always kind of looked at them as hurdles. It's like, you're not in my way. You're just there to prove to everybody how high I can jump. And that's the way I looked at it. And it really took a while for me to get to that space, because I thought, for the most part, I failed. I thought I failed, and I was promoting the film, and I was really depressed because I had something on paper and I had an idea in my head. And any director will tell you this, right? I mean, like, the meeting place between those two, the ideas on paper and in your head and reality, I mean, that therein lies. So for me, there were so many things that I'd left on the page or didn't have the money or time to execute the way I wanted to. I felt like I had failed. And when you fail as a native person, a native director, you're not really just helming that misery. You're kind of taking it on for a lot of other people. And for the first part of the release before the pandemic, I was, the film was kind of getting ragged on by people who I thought I made it for. And it kind of took the pandemic to bring into relief the themes in the film, and then everybody was like, oh, now I get it. So that was boistered a lot by my confidence, and the film itself was boistered a lot by people who reviewed it and people who were, you know, better equipped at seeing the movie objectively for what it was and not knowing, like, all the things we left out, like all the things you don't know as a director, right? So once that happened, I was able to get some distance, because it's been out now since TIFF, which was in September, which is next month. So it's been about a year before I really began to see it for the first time. Because I watched it at TIFF, and then I didn't go watch it again until, like, Shudder did an online viewing party. And that's the second time that I saw it. I was like, it's not as bad as I thought it was. So when I got to that space, I was able to start unpacking the film more objectively. Because it's like, I'm not just a writer-director, I'm also the editor and composer. So I lived with this film for like 2 years, like writing it, directing it, then, you know, sitting down and doing the edit, and then, you know, watching it all again for the music. And I'm typically there when we're doing the sound effects too. So, you know, by that time, you're already sick of it. And I needed distance, and I needed to kind of process the whole experience. And it was wild, man. I mean, like, I had a hard time afterwards where I was pretty lethargic and depressed, like seriously depressed. Not suicidal or anything, but like, I was definitely questioning whether or not I wanted to continue making films. I was, you know, I was questioning my ability as a filmmaker, like, you know, maybe I don't have this talent after all. And the one thing that you get a lot of when you're a minority filmmaker, and I'm sure, you know, any Mexican or black filmmaker, or any minority filmmaker tell you the same thing, you're asking to bear the weight of the entire culture.
Mm-hmm.
And every time you miss it, you feel like you're failing more than just yourself. Like, you know, the Brett Ratners of the world can make crummy movies and walk away from them. Whereas I feel like I can't. Like every time I step to the plate, I feel like I got to knock it out of the park, because not only do people almost forcibly put you in that spot of representing all Native people, but you kind of do it to yourself too,
mm-hmm.
even though you know logistically that's insane and there's no real way to justify that. You feel like they're doing that anyway. And there's a third aspect to it where you feel like the industry will look at you and say, okay, this guy failed. We need to stop doing representation because it doesn't sell. So it's a lot of weight, man. It's just, yeah. You know, it's a wonder that any Native filmmaker manages to make it up to the space of completing a film, because a feature film in and of itself is, you know, such a daunting task. But when you start taking up all this other slack, it becomes impossible.
Yeah, it seems like there's almost like you're being asked to hit a grand slam every time you go up to the plate where there's only like one guy on base. But this movie, since, you know, I have to tell you, you did hit that grand slam in my book. The acting, the portrayal of the collapse, the music, oh my God, the music, the music, the song that was playing over the end credits almost made me cry. So I think you did an awesome job.
Thank you. I'm glad to survive it.
Now, where can people find you online to keep track of your next project? Because I am on that list, sir.
I'm always making trouble on Twitter. And,
awesome.
I'm on Instagram too, but oddly enough, I'm more of a Twitter user. So that's where I am right now. And project-wise, I'm kind of doing a cosmic horror piece that I'm really excited about. That's delving into a lot of the issues that we're in the middle of right now, and fielding offers.
Awesome. Well, you said cosmic horror. You got my attention with that. We'll definitely keep an eye on that. Jeff Barnaby, the writer, director, and all around everything else for the movie Blood Quantum, please go see this movie. Check it out. It comes out on DVD, Blu-ray, and digital on September 1st. I believe it is still playing on Shudder, so this is your excuse to sign up for Shudder. Go see this movie. You will not be disappointed. Jeff, thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Slice of Sci-Fi. Like I said, Blood Quantum is a movie well worth watching if you want something a little different from your typical trope-laden zombie film, one that has a few topics and perspectives that might make you think a little bit. And yeah, I'm actually curious if there will be a soundtrack for this and a sequel, a follow-on story. We shall see. So again, this movie will be out on Blu-ray, DVD, digital, and video on demand on September 1st. Go check it out. Like I said, I believe it's still playing in Shudder. I don't know if that changes after the first or not. I should probably look into that. Anyway, for those of you keeping track, yes, there will be a contest starting sometime after September 1st. The prize will be the 4K release of Batman Hush, one of the DC animated features from last year. Haven't decided yet which format of contest it will be, if it will be a secret sauce contest run through the website or a contest giveaway where people answer a question either on Twitter or in the comments on the website. But as soon as I know, you'll know. If you have any questions or comments on zombie films with deeper characters, deeper stories, deeper themes, many layers of topics that make you want to root for the characters a little bit more, or think about the world they are living in, they will have to live in, if and when their zombie plague ends, give me a call. The number is 602-635-6976, or shoot me an email, summer@sliceofscifi.com. You can listen to Slice of Sci-Fi on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play Podcasts, TuneIn, Player FM, and iHeartRadio Podcasts. And if you're listening on either Apple or Stitcher, please leave us a review. Let folks know you're enjoying the show, and maybe they should check it out for themselves. You can follow us on Twitter, @SliceOfSciFi. And you can find us over on YouTube, youtube.com/sliceofscifi. And of course, there's always the website, sliceofscifi.com. Come on by, leave your own opinion on some of the movie and TV reviews that have been done. We welcome the time-honored pastime of geek discussions. I'd like to thank everyone who is currently supporting this show and all the others in the Slice of Sci-Fi universe, including Writers After Dark and Babylon Podcast. Your donations, your pledges, your signal boosting all help. So please continue to do so. And if you're new to the show and want to consider adding your support, the place to go is patreon.com/sliceofscifi. You can choose a level and be eligible to win one of the monthly perks. Everyone who's in as a supporter, as a patron, is eligible to select a book, a Blu-ray, a DVD, a 4K from the selection I have here. We have sci-fi, we have horror, even a few documentaries over there that I see, and they all need new homes. So what better way to show my gratitude to all of you for supporting the efforts here by sharing some of these items with you. And if a monthly pledge through Patreon is not currently in your budget, but you still want to help, the link to use is paypal.me/scifisummer. Every little bit counts. Seriously, every dime from the donations and the pledges, all of it keeps it all online. So again, thank you for your support. And that'll do it for this episode. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.